Welcome, everyone. If you could please grab a few refreshments and have a seat, I think we're going to get started. We really are trying to be committed here to keeping to our time schedules on our agenda so that everyone really can get out by 3 o'clock and have a little bit of time to enjoy the rest of this beautiful day. Thank you very much for being here. We really do appreciate the commitment of everyone who's given up a Saturday and a holiday season, beautiful weather, to come and join us and learn about form-based codes. We think it's a really, really important topic. For those of you who I don't know, and I know many of you, but for those of you I don't know, I'm Gwen Wright. I'm the Acting Planning Director here in the Montgomery County Planning Department, and we are the sponsors of this day. We're putting this event together, and we view it as an opportunity to educate ourselves and our constituents and all the interested parties in the county about form-based codes. It's a term that's been thrown around a lot. People have talked about form-based codes, and what we realized is it means something a little different to everyone we talk to. And so we want to get everyone together and really hear from some of the folks who are most expert in this field from all around the country and get a really good understanding of what form-based codes are and how they can potentially help us in Montgomery County move towards a sustainable future that's grounded in community design excellence. We feel very optimistic that there's a great deal of potential here, and hope that by the end of the day today, we will all go out with maybe more knowledge and some direction that this is an area that we need to pursue. I'd like to just quickly introduce the speakers who will be with us today. It's a very impressive group, and I know we'll enjoy hearing from them. First, Jeffrey Farrell, who is a partner with Farrell Madden Associates in Washington, D.C. He has been working for the last two decades on producing urban design projects across the United States. Before establishing his own firm in 1992, he was a designer and code writer with Duane Plater Zyberk Architects and Town Planners. He served as 2 years as the Director of Urban Design for the Treasure Coast Regional Planning Council in Florida. And he's currently working on very innovative projects on mixed-use codes in Prince George's County, a master plan with form-based codes in the Columbia Pike Corridor, and new zoning projects in Denver, Colorado, and a number of other communities. The next speaker after Mr. Farrell will be Lee Einsweiler, who is a principal with a group in Austin called Code Studio. He also has more than 20 years of experience in urban redevelopment, working in South Florida, Denver, Memphis, and Savannah. He has actually been responsible for the complete revision and adoption of over 20 zoning codes in jurisdictions across the country. So he brings to us a great deal of practical experience that I think will be very useful. He's an adjunct faculty member in the Department of Community and Regional Planning at the University of Texas, and we are really pleased that he can be here with us from Austin. The third speaker who will speak during our lunchtime period is Roger Lewis. And many of you have read Roger Lewis's columns in the Washington Post and know that he has a wonderful viewpoint on architecture and urban design issues. What you may not know is that he's also a practicing architect. He is also an educator who is a professor emeritus at the University of Maryland School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. And as an author, he has actually published several books on the profession of architecture and on growth management. He has written a book called Architect, A Candid Guide to the Profession, that is used in architectural schools, graduate schools around the United States to help educate young architects. And he co-authored a widely disseminated publication, The Growth Management Handbook. Our next speaker after lunch is going to be Richard Tucker, who is currently an acting master planning team supervisor with the Department of Community Planning, Housing, and Development in Arlington, Virginia. He was very, very involved in managing the Columbia Pike Initiative for 5 years. And much of what we've heard about all the good work that's happened in Arlington's Columbia Pike Corridor is, I'm sure, due to his hard work. He'll be telling us a lot about that. He really spearheaded the development of form-based code for the Columbia Pike area. Prior to working on that project, he worked as a senior program manager for Fairfax County's revitalization program. Our final speaker, and a person who I think many of you have probably met through our master plan reassessment effort, is Dina Roadside. She's a director and co-founder of Roadside and Harwell in Arlington, Virginia, and she has been active in planning and community outreach for over 30 years. She's very involved in public outreach, how to get public involvement in the planning process. She also knows how to write wonderful plans that address issues like urban revitalization, form-based codes, and environmental strategies. So I think that we have a wonderful group of sort of outside experts coming in to share with us the information that may help us move forward. I also want to note that we will be in the afternoon having a panel discussion that will be moderated by our own Royce Hansen, chairman of our planning board, and he will be hearing. We will be hearing a little not only formal presentations but some more informal discussion with our speakers during that panel discussion. To that end, what you will see is that in the information packets that you received, there are note cards. And as you're listening to the presentations in the morning and early afternoon, if you have questions or specific topics that you think should be addressed during the panel discussion later in the afternoon, please jot those questions down, write them down, pass them to either Melissa Bannock or to myself. There's a box in the back that Melissa has that you can drop your cards in, and we will make sure they get to the panel for them to address during that panel discussion. We are going to do our best, as I said, to stick to our time limits so that we can move forward and, again, have folks out by 3 o'clock. And to that end, I will stop speaking and turn things over to Royce Hansen, who will introduce our first speaker.
Thanks, Graham. I think in looking at what we're trying to do today is to see it in the context of a larger effort that we have underway in the county to do a couple of things. One is to improve the quality of design for all the development that occurs, whether it's new development or redevelopment. We've pioneered a lot of things in this county over the years as far as planning is concerned. But one of the things that was apparent to me after my Rip Van Winkle reappearance here after 25 years is that the zoning code, among other things, has grown, as I explained to some groups earlier, like a glacial accretion. One of my sons is a geologist, and he reminds me that the principal difference between an institutional glacier and a natural one is that an institutional glacier, the crud ends up on top. And we've had a kind of a geological accretion of zoning text amendments over the years that are designed to fix problems that the zoning code didn't anticipate and doesn't seem to be able to adapt itself to. Some of these are perfectly reasonable. Some of them sort of stretch credulity, but they're interesting. Well, as I looked at this, I'm reminded of an essay that appeared in a book that I edited some years ago on growth management, in which one of the authors, in explaining the topic of the day, said, what we're doing isn't working, but we're doing it better than we ever have. That's sort of where we are with the existing zoning code. It's important that we have a close relationship between the planning that we do and the tools that we have to implement those plans and carry them out and achieve the kind of vision that people work so hard to establish through the planning process. So we asked the council, and they agreed to let us begin a revision of the zoning ordinance as one of those very important fundamental tools of achieving our plans. They've also agreed that we should pursue with both public sector and private sector development a much higher level of design quality than we have seen in the county historically. So we're going to explore some new ideas. One of these new ideas is form-based zoning. It seems to have a great deal of potential. We want to see how much, how it can be adapted or used in the county. There's enough experience nationally with it now that we've got a lot of things from which we can learn. And so we want to learn those things. We want to get a little smarter. We want to see what we can use. We want to see what we can improve upon. The exercise is probably going to take a full 3 years, probably a couple weeks after that. But we need to get started. We've got several plans that will be coming before the council this next year. And getting the zones ready to address the ideas in those plans is very important. So this morning is an opportunity to begin to explore some of these things. Now, some folks are probably going to be worried about what will happen if we make changes, if we approach things in a different way. A little over 100 years ago, when public administration was first being created as a field of inquiry, Woodrow Wilson, who was then a professor at Princeton, wrote an essay published in a very important learned journal called the Women's Home Journal, said that a lot of people were objecting because he had suggested at one time that one of the models that should be looked at was the model of the Prussian general staff. And people said, well, we don't all want to be Prussians and approach things the way they did. He said, well, let's take a different analogy. Let's learn what we can from wherever there's something to be learned. He said, you know, you can tie someone to a tree and prevent them from doing anything evil, but you also prevent them from doing anything. So let's take the good that we can find and apply it and use it and build on it. And let's begin to develop systems that make sure that what we're emphasizing are the good qualities that can be applied in an area. So to start us off this morning, Jeffrey Farrell is going to talk with us about his experience and observations with the use of form-based zoning. He's worked on a large number of projects throughout the country. He has been born and educated. He holds a Master of Architecture degree with a certificate in American Urbanism. And he has in a variety of places around the country, including really exotic territories such as Prince George's County, and he's here to help us. So, Jeffrey, welcome.
Are we on yet? It's warming up. I think there might be a third of us in the room who are getting over some kind of a cold, so pardon my froggy-like voice. I'm going to launch into this quickly. I have a habit that I can't seem to get away from of trying to show too much in too little time, and I'll do that again. The important stuff is not here. It's going to be up on the screen. Oh, stop. Don't you love technology? We had a little technical difficulty here, don't worry. This has never happened to me before. That's what. I could sing a little bit for you, but that would just clear the room. I think the problem is this got jiggled and told it something strange. Aha. This isn't the most important slide you'll see tonight. But it's close. It's in the top five of thoughts to take home with you. Form-based codes are just form-based codes, and it's about form-based, not form-only. A lot of people tend to take, when we talk about this, they somehow grab onto the lesson about form, and they forget the other aspects of it. We won't tell you that. We promise. It's just form-based instead of the current Euclidean system, which is really use-based. And we apparently have an unprecedented problem. That looks good. That doesn't.
Reboot. I'll just go ahead and transfer the slides for you. Okay. Just say next slide. I'll do it for you.
Okay. You can probably get it up to 50%. Okay. Next slide. This is, you're not supposed to be able to read that text. This is just a little establishing, making the point that it's something that's been done a lot. And these are projects that Farrell Madden has worked on. A lot of other people have done this as well. Next slide. As has been said before, recognize national trend. This has happened already in a lot of places. There's been an incredible amount of interest in it. However, there aren't that many projects that have resulted in buildings getting built. As you all know, these things just take time. Next slide. Okay. Okay. If we're talking about a new system, the first question is, what's wrong with the current system? Next. And part of the issue there is, well, are the current results good enough? Just look at what we've been getting. The kind of things that really just aren't loved. Not that they're bad, but somehow they're not working together synergistically. Prince William County. If we can pick on Prince William County, it's actually, we're not picking on Prince William County here because it's different, but we're using it as an example because it's so very common. This is a piece of their comprehensive plan, rewritten in 1998, has a statement about common sense. They want physically sound, livable communities, etc. I don't think you're ever going to see a comp plan that wants unlivable communities or calls for physically disastrous growth. Well, here's some of the stuff they got, and I do believe it was built after 1998. Oh, sorry. Here's their zoning map. Look at all those colors. No lack of effort or control here. There's so many colors on the zoning map, the human eye loses the ability to discern the shades, so we start introducing hatches and dots and cross hatches. But here's what they've got. Now, is that livable? We can talk about the qualitative issues, but is that sustainable in just physical terms? And the answer is no. This development, when it first comes in, will pay for the first generation of roads. Maybe we'll pay for the extension of sewers and water. But over time, will it pay for, over time, the extension of fire and police protection? Will it pay for, will it generate enough tax base so that in 10 years when you have to repave those roads, they pay for themselves? And the answer is, below a certain level of density, no, because we're spreading out so much. We've got more surface area. Everybody is stretched thin. What this kind of sprawl development means is everybody else's taxes are going to go up in the county eventually because this stuff doesn't pay for itself. Why don't we build the great places anymore? Well, here's a key part of that. Here's a policy statement quite literally taken from El Cerrito, California's plan. They're asking for, and they want infill and develop in existing urbanized areas, build affordable multifamily housing near transportation corridors. Well, if you look at the image below, which is not a real image, that's actually a Photoshopped image, a little presto changeo. I think this is the kind of thing, it may be a little bit of a California style, but that seems like a pretty good realization of that goal. You got affordable housing, multifamily housing on a transportation corridor, and it looks like a livable place. That looks to me like the kind of place that we might imagine when we write that goal. Well, keep your eye on the Subaru there, because that's the real untouched image. And this is what you get. It's the conflict between our regulations and our goals. you know that everything in that image is highly regulated. The number of lanes, the width of the lanes, the left turn lane, the curb radii, the crossing, all of that. There's a lot of specifications and rules for that. Probably even the kind of Northwoods landscaping across the street that in this case is trying to probably buffer the housing from this street, or actually this highway. Our regulations have taken us over. It's a little bit of too much abstraction. And we need to turn that around and let the technical aspect of our lives adapt a little bit and use our technology and our brains to give us a better vision. Point being, in the realization of our human settlements today, we've gotten things kind of backwards. We've letting the individual technical things take over. We give all of those 100%, and the overall result is more like a 60% place. Some people have tried to make the world better by focusing on aesthetic design guidelines, what I'd call exterior decoration. Let's talk about another Virginia County, Albemarle. This is about a project that went through. A developer brought a project on the edge of the city of Charlottesville in the county. He came before the board of Architectural Review. Something between a dozen and half a dozen times, they kicked this guy back. They said, no, go back and work on your project. And they were honestly trying to make the project better. They made this person clad the building in brick, sort of like Monticello. This is Thomas Jefferson's house up on the hill. And my partner Mary Madden there. If anyone's ever been to Monticello, you probably have a picture of one of your friends standing in about the same spot. It's the ubiquitous Monticello shot. Well, they also made this guy put white trim, and they couldn't get a portico on his project, but he got the pediment up against it. White trim, shutters, red brick. They kept sending this project back, trying to affect the kind of exterior decoration of this project as if they were trying to make turn it into Monticello and thereby make it a better project. Well, more fundamental issues were at hand. Red brick is nice, and the portico we can talk about in those pilasters, but the real problem here is something different. It's more fundamental. It's the form of the way these things are arranged. This picture, if you can squint and look in the background, it's also an example of quote unquote mixed use. You see those condos in the back? Well, there's probably somebody living there as a student at UVA, and they could, if they had some climbing gear, they could rappel down that wall and go over to the Toys R Us and do some shopping. It's about the form of things at the scale of the individual building, not so much as at the scale of all these individual buildings working together and making a bigger place. Some people have tried to deal with that in terms of what I would call addressing the symptoms, the idea that the bigger the difference between uses, the bigger the buffer. And that there's a place for that, but I think it's limited. We don't get rid of that kind of tool completely, but there are more fundamental things at work. Again, I remind you of all that effort and really generations of planners trying to make things better, but the fundamental tools are wrong. Consider the colors on the zoning map. Well, this is red on the zoning map. It's commercial of a form. But think of it as a human place where you're going to have your kids grow up, versus this, also red on a zoning map. There, of course, there are other things involved. This is a commercial spot serving much the same place in our society as this is, only this and a lot more. Completely different human environments. What's healthier for the culture? I can see that we've got some interesting animations, meaning ones that won't work. Floor area ratio is something that we love to make fun of. It's an example of complete physical unpredictability for the sake of statistical precision. And we all know those statistics are whether it's the school population, et cetera, even however many points that to the right of the decimal point the numbers go out, they're still just approximations. But somehow we've let that guide our planning and our regulations. An FAR of 1 could be a set of flats like they are on the left. These are New York pictures. Or it could be a tower sitting back in the middle of the block like this Chicago Streeterville building. So this is about unpredictability in reality, even though in terms of statistics, great predictability. Everybody hates sprawl, and to that I would add lousy development. But, you know, the builders are really building. They may try and build the rules, bend the rules, but really they're building what the rules tell them to. Talking about regulating form versus density, we've all been sort of taught that it's all about density. More dense is more bad, and no one would build that big blob of butter. It looks like the zoning blob of tofu. But, of course, they have. Pardon the technical difficulties, but the difference between these two images, this is another photo montage, that's the reality, the Streeterville neighborhood of Chicago. People came out and said, that's just way too dense. But really the problem with these towers with the big deadly blank podiums is not the density, because this might even be more dense. The difference between the before and the after, that big blank wall, one is just a statistical thing. It's residential, and it's a big FAR. But it doesn't talk about how it addresses and makes that street a living place. Suddenly here you can imagine, this is still, the towers are still there. This is still, the technical term I think is Mondo density or something like that. It's incredible density, but it also looks very livable. Doesn't mean this kind of, I'm trying to get aside from the, There are probably limits to density and appropriate density, and this is extremely high. But what's most important here, it's not about the density. The residents maybe shouldn't have been protesting the density as much as what's really a pretty heinous arrangement. Well, why don't we build the great places anymore? Back to that question. We built a lot of places that are neither city nor country. There's a great example, the subdivision named after the species of flora or fauna that used to be there. Unfortunately, a lot of this stuff, when the first ring suburbs were built, there was a lot about them that was wonderful. But when a suburb is buried miles deep in other suburbs, Mother Nature is really gone. Sort of the worst thing for Mother Nature. Why did we start doing this stuff? This is, apologies, the 60-second covering 5 centuries a time. So it's a little bit simplistic. But with the traditional city in the Industrial Revolution, there were really serious problems. There were serious technical problems in Europe and in America. We all remember things like this, actually. I'm not that old. But things like this, these were very real problems that made cities hard to live in. There were real problems of health. Unfortunately, instead of solving the technical problem in the way back into the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, we applied fundamental solutions, fundamentally different solutions, and we tried to come up with a logic where suddenly you read this quote and think about the way we do things today. 1927, Mort Sirt. It's scarily prophetic. We started to build completely different places. The sketch on the top, a sketch of by the architect Le Corbusier, what he wanted Paris to be. And you look at all that open space that seemed wonderfully romantic. Those little cars there, they're open-top cars with Isadora Duncan driving in them. Seems really romantic. But you know, we built that stuff. And it ain't romantic. Not at all. And whether it's at the high density level or the low density level, you know, we built it from California and Kentucky to New Hampshire. And we know there are a lot of problems with it. But then think about the link between that, the kind of avant-garde intellectual, and this, the ordinance village of Euclid, Ohio, got into a lawsuit with Ambler Realty, beginning of zoning. The avant-garde becomes the bureaucratic, and off we went. From that simple zoning ordinance to this state. Actually, these are Los Angeles codes. I would imagine the Montgomery situation might be a book lighter, maybe not. So to jump a minute to the idea of what we're about here, sort of the great American small town, this is an idyllic image, but this idea of being of having a place where you can work, sleep, worship, conduct your business, and understanding it as a place is something that also applies to cities. I'd say this is the real American dream, not necessarily at this scale, but at this kind of community. At the base of that is understanding that our towns are not just abstract statistics that we have to figure out what they're going to add up to. They're places. And what does it take to make a good place? In our work around the country, we're finding some real consistencies, set of points here that are kind of ubiquitous to Americans and maybe larger than that. People like a vital downtown and build upon the qualities that are already there. Especially on the eastern half of the United States, there's already a lot of good stuff there that you can anchor and expand on. People want real neighborhoods, actually more than gated communities. Walkable streets, which, by the way, is not rocket science, but we stopped doing it a few years ago. And besides avoiding the auto-oriented strip, we've got to convert it, and when we build new stuff out there, and sometimes it's not out there, sometimes it's in, it's got to be in a better form. Recognize the unique community character. This is the unique community character of Marquette, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula. They have a different temperature today than we do. And don't forget about Mother Nature. It's human nature and Mother Nature both work together. I'll jump to a basic point about regulation today. We'd say it's out of balance. If you're going to make a town or a city, any kind of real human settlement, there's some basic things you have to deal with. The physical form, because something's going to get built, like that Toys R Us. The use and density, this is the category of things we currently, I would suggest, hyper-control to mixed results. And finally, management issues. Examples like when you have on-street parking or not, rush hour parking or not. When you have at the pub in the neighborhood, what time the band has to shut down so that somebody doesn't call the mayor at 3 o'clock in the morning, so he doesn't call your boss at 4 o'clock in the morning and complain about it. These are human issues. They're always going to be there. Well, I'd suggest what happens today, this is the imbalance. We go way overboard in use and density. Management is probably worse than it has to be. And if we deal with physical form, it tends to get tossed in at the end. And then it tends to get dealt with in the form of exterior decoration. Let's make the buildings more pretty to deal with the problem. And it's not that that isn't important, but that's not the big deal. If you only remember one image, one concept, please make it this one. When we're talking about form-based regulations, we're not talking about form only, but the suggestion is that by dealing with form, you thereby deal with and you kind of corral other issues of management and use. Use doesn't go away, but we don't hyperventilate about it. We allow it more flexibility. In some places, you'll control it tightly. In other places, you can let it change and be more flexible and respond to the market. And the argument for form is, bottom line, what is the difference statistically, in Euclidean terms, between this mixed-use, medium-density transportation corridor and this one? They're not that far apart. They're both in Virginia. This is Washington Street headed towards town. This is Columbia Pike near the Fairfax border, looking towards the district. By the way, I would suggest that Washington Street might actually carry more traffic at rush hour. That's intermittent parking on the side during when it's the rush hour that goes away. So the real difference is, and by the way, the real difference between these two, it's not red brick in Georgian architecture, although I really love that stuff. There's some really fundamental issues of form looking at these two places. We've been taught to really focus for a couple of generations, especially our civic activists, on form. But look at these two images. And these are both what I would call kind of mediocre or worse townhouse projects. But this first one, just by virtue, it fronts the street. It has a door for human beings and windows on the front. Now, in abstract terms, this is about the same product, but by virtue of putting the garage on the front, there's no back, there's no rear alley entry. Look what happens to the street. Which of these two streets do you want your son, daughter, or parent to walk home by? One is for people, one is for cars. And in both of them, of course, they both could use some better street trees. But that simple aspect of form makes an incredible difference in the world of function and livability. Let's talk about parking a little bit. To have an open parking structure in a city, on a city street, it's like a sucking chest wound in the city. It just sucks the life off of the city. And if you look at these two people here, if you were perhaps a woman, you might be a little nervous about walking down. These guys look, it's an unsafe or unsettling position. I actually know one of those guys is me, and I'm pretty meek and mild. But look at these other examples where they still have parking. Parking is part of the program of a city, and we have to deal with it. But we deal with it in smart ways. We don't put it front and center any more than when you walk into the front door of someone's house, you walk through the bathroom. This is an example in Clarendon. The parking is there, and I know I've done this myself. I do believe most people who walk by this street, especially if they're on the other side of the street, they have no idea that they're walking by a parking structure. What they are actually walking by, in addition to a parking structure, is they're walking by a enlivened street front. They're walking on what is a continuation of a lively retail street. The parking is up above. It's a little bit nicer because it has the vertically oriented windows instead of huge strips. But fundamentally, this is a place where they understood that at a minimum, they had to save the ground floor and not have exposed parking there. This would be a better solution. This is kind of a B-plus solution. They had a small block. This is the best they could do. An ideal solution would be to have liners of residences or office going all the way up to front. But I like this example because they recognized the most important thing. They had to make a compromise, but they recognized what was most important and saved it. Lessons. Look at this piece of Chicago. This is, in the abstract, a great thing. They've gotten new development to come into what had been a kind of lagging area of close-in Chicago. Problem is, they brought it in a suburban form. The worst thing you can do is to build the suburbs in the city. Now, if you look at that, it's a great, great business, great activity, but you know that's expensive infrastructure there? Lots of money for flags, benches, the fence, and it's all good stuff, except even people who don't have a home, the homeless people are going to avoid this place because it's no place. There's simply no there. Not about a lack of spending public monies. Well, what if they had, instead of doing the suburban form, they got that same development and built it up to the street? The parking lot is in the back. Parking won't go away, but it could look like this. There's a parking lot in back. People like that maids formed space of the street. It's sort of not rocket science. Suddenly you can understand those benches as a place that people would feel comfortable sitting. Launch into form-based codes and what they are at base. The following is a set of pictures that a graphic representation. This is a piece of Columbia Pike out west, right by Four Mile Run, actually. This is a place that's very well regulated right now in terms of use and density. What a form-based code does is lay over the land really the definition of where the private blocks are, where the street is, where the street edge needs to be. You can imagine this. The public sector can build that sidewalk. They can plant the trees. They can put in light rail, traffic lanes, etc. But really, it's kind of a blank drawing in a dead space without the private sector. The public sector here, you set the rules of the game. You define where the buildings go and set the rules for that game of economy. But you can set the rules, but it's a dead space until the private sector builds something. What's really making this place come to life is the creation of a, well, frankly, profit. These buildings get built, the businesses operate, people live in these buildings and work in these buildings because it's a healthy economic place. Making a good city is really the ultimate public-private partnership. Basic point, the public sector sets the rules, but the private sector builds the place. What's street space about? And really, what are form-based codes? To look at them in the abstract, sort of the suggestion of a form-based code is, look at your great places and learn from them in terms of function and form. If you look at this main street, and let's assume for a minute you think that's an A main street, it's a good model. You notice, it could be better, but one of the things you notice about it in terms of height, the buildings, there's a range of height. Obviously, that can get out of line, with the picture in the upper right is suggesting. You can have too much difference in height, but because that relationship is important, that's one of the things you should be coding directly. Don't mess around and let that be an accident. Just talk about that range directly. Second thing on siding. If you look at these buildings, the architectural style is actually very varied. They're all over the place. They've been built at different times. One thing they agree upon within an inch is they all shoulder right up to the sidewalk within a few inches. Again, the picture in the upper right, here's what happens when you get that wrong. This idea of that build-to line that the buildings form, the street space, is so important. It's fundamental. Your code should talk about that. Notice the code isn't being very specific about what happens behind the building or how deep the building is. That's more in the private realm, and it's their business. An example of that, you put the building up front, you get that street space. There's something else you get, which is also you pull the building away from the buildings behind it. In a perfect world, there'll be gardens, and the children will be playing behind there. Until we get the perfect world, that space behind the building will have garbage and parking. Actually, even in a perfect world, the garbage will be in the back. But when you put that space up in front and you get that relationship reversed, you start to cause problems. One is less flexible than the other. And whoever's living right behind that commercial building has the dumpsters, the building, the deliveries, etc., pushed right up against them. Sort of instant affordable housing in a bad way. Another element that's important to form-based codes, basic things, windows and doors are not just about style. And actually, I think there's some questions about coding them about style. But windows and doors are functional elements. And your code should make sure that those fit in a parameter so that you get a functioning main street, functioning residential streets. And we're always tempted to say, well, of course, no one's going to build a building without any doors or windows. But of course, they have. And I think we don't have to go too far out the front door here to see that. There are different ways buildings front. Residential fronts the street differently than retail. Civic buildings like churches and City Hall front the street differently. And those private buildings need to be coded appropriately. In a residential building, you want the front rooms to look out over the street and survey them. from, frankly, a superior position. That's the eyes on the street. Well, from a retail, and it can happen with an office frontage as well, you want something very different. You want that retail space to have a kind of promiscuous relationship with the sidewalk. It's a healthy promiscuity in this case. You definitely don't want that with residential. Residential that's right up against the sidewalk on the ground floor is a definite no-no and will fail. And you need to code those things. We all know these uses mix. We talk a lot about buffers, and we have a history of buffers. Our current zoning system is very much about keeping things apart. If things are different, they have to be apart and isolated. But we all know if we look at our old cities, and I think we just sort of forgotten that we used to do this so easily. If you're driving or walking down Main Street, if you take a right turn down a local street, you know, it's not more Main Street. Maybe if you're downtown, you get some of that. But what makes those places really work is a complementary relationship between a residential side street and the Main Street. It's not that hard, and it's works. It's fairly easy to code that transition. You don't put a buffer between those two. You put a way for those two edges to mate. It should be a privilege to live just down the street from Main Street because you're that much closer. You can walk out your front door and walk down Main Street and have all those choices. But you have to make sure those two different things come together in a complementary fashion. The commercial and mixed-use buildings of Main Street don't tower over and aren't a negative to the residentials behind them. A point about uses, which is first you can have, you don't treat all uses or regulate them in an equal way. In some places, a use is more important than others. On this example, kind of a low-level Main Street, what's most important to this woman and her baby, well, maybe the kid doesn't care much, but is what's happening on that ground floor. It makes a real direct difference on the street. There's kind of a one-to-one relationship there. So if you're trying to make a Main Street, what you see in this picture, it's very important that those are retail shops. This environment is very much about that kind of exchange. But what about what happens on the second and third floors? I would suggest that can be an either-or. You can have a much lighter hand on that. It makes a difference if it's retail or if it's residential, but not a fundamental one. If it's residential, at night it's going to be light, and at lunchtime it's going to be quiet. If it's office, you know that at 8, 12, and 5, it's going to be very busy. So there's a difference, but you don't need to control it. And very much it's different for residential. That said, a point, little residential street, if you look at that spot right there, this is suddenly going to become a mixed-use building. Maybe it's a dentist's office. The point isn't at all that you can just drop anything into a residential area, but you can be, in general, about uses more relaxed because that building is controlled in its form. Also, the density and the intensity of what can go there is somewhat controlled. By controlling the form, you're also corralling aspects of the use. I'm going to jump ahead. A big part of the promise of a form-based code, right under the current system, we've got developers out there, and we put them in the position of cowboys, lone players on the mean, high, dusty plains. The developer who's building this project, which is in Johnson City, Tennessee, he's building on what is an ugly Sunset Drive. That's a mean street. So what he's done is he's turned his back to it and created an internal street because he's afraid of that street. That street is ugly and damaging to his real estate and ugly and damaging to any human being who walks down it. So he's created his own street and put up a wall, which actually makes the problem worse. But that's the system we put the developer in. What if he didn't have to do that, and what if he knew there were rules that are going to make that street less of a road and more of a street, and also going to make the person who builds next to him and across the street from him build in a positive way too? This photo imaging, we just turned his building around. No increase in expense, actually less of that brick wall. Already it looks a little bit better. Minimal expense. The city planted street trees. A little bit of extra care, some minor landscaping, a little fencing just to make the place look a little better. And it looks like a completely different place. Of course, we still have to fix the road. But this is a place that starts to contribute value to the city instead of making that problem more concrete. We've got to come up with a system where these different actors work together. We also know this is something, this is so much, we're in so much better world than we were about 10 years ago, because people know this is actually a better way to go. People are rebuilding dead malls. This project in Chattanooga, rebuilding dead malls and starting to take them towards the, in the direction of a city. And that radical left-wing journal, the Wall Street Journal, they go way out on limbs all the time. 1996 article, people are spurning the mall for Main Street. Obviously, what's happened in downtown Silver Spring is a good example of that. And a quick point about the environment, which I hope everybody in here cares about. That's why we have to build good cities. Mixed-use development is the best management practice. Here's something about the point, a recent discovery. The most important thing in environmentalism, I would say, is making compact mixed-use development, making towns and cities, not suburbs. Here's some quotes. I found this pretty interesting, but look at that thing on the bottom. They did a study and discovered for an office building built to modern energy codes, more than twice as much energy is used by commuters coming and going to get to that building than by the building itself. The most important aspect of sustainability and of saving our earth is to build cities, walkable, mixed-use cities. That gets you a hell of a lot more energy than all the things you can do with green building. And that's not to say you shouldn't do those green building things, but we've got to set up the framework for all our buildings that is this more environmentally sensitive. With that, I will cut it off so we'll be on schedule. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. We're now scheduled to take a 15-minute break.
Please grab a cup of coffee, have a seat. We have a great presentation coming up by Lee Einsweiler, and we want to have enough time for it. Could you all please take a seat?
Please be seated.
I just wanted to mention that we will have a period for questions and answers after Mr. Einsweiler's presentation. And then again, do write down any ideas or questions on the note cards for the panel discussion and put them in the box at the back of the room.
It's a particular pleasure for me to introduce Lee Einsweiler, who happens to be the son of a good friend and a colleague of mine at the University of Minnesota. His dad, Bob Einsweiler, was the head of the planning program at the Humphrey Institute when I worked there a few years back. And so it's great to see a second generation carrying on with the good work. So welcome, Lee.
I actually consider myself third generation. My granddad was a mayor in a small town, and if ever there was a planner, it's the mayor of a small town. I was asked to make sure that everybody understood I had some credentials. I guess Royce kind of gave me the credentials over the dinner table for all those many years. I did sort of learn at the knees of the master, but I have spent the last, especially the last about 12 years, specifically working solely on plan implementation, mostly on codes. I do consider myself an expert in conventional zoning. I've been working on some